Well, Brother Bruce will be commencing his fifth and final study shortly, which is entitled The Gibeonite Deception. But prior to that, we'll ask our Brother Martin Russell if he'll come forward and read to us Joshua chapter 9, and then I'll ask Brother Bruce if he can come immediately after that and commence his study.
Well, thanks, Brother David. Good afternoon, brethren, sisters and young people. If you're worried about the blood on my collar, I haven't cut myself shaving. My son had an altercation with a fixed metal post in about a metre of concrete, and he lost the altercation. He's fine, though. Everything's fine. Okay. Well, we've been talking about leadership this weekend, and I hope that we've painted a fairly balanced picture of leadership. It's not all just, you know, a bowl of cherries where you just stridently get out there and, you know, you're just the leader and you're made of stainless steel and all that sort of stuff. We're going to see, and we've already seen it, we're going to see, God willing, this afternoon, that leaders make mistakes. Sometimes they make colossal mistakes. And sometimes, being leaders, they're very public mistakes. And they've got to fix them publicly, not only to fix the problem, but also to glorify God. It's one thing to fix a problem, but you've also got this interweave of glorifying God in the process. And that's a tough gig. That's pretty complex, and you've got to really know what you're doing. And we're going to see what Joshua did on this occasion where he dropped the ball. We're going to see how recovery of mistakes, there is a process by which we recover from our mistakes. Because the scriptures are replete with examples of people who, in trying to recover from a mistake, made more of a mess. I mean, you don't have to go very far. King David himself, not that I want to put the boot into King David, but King David himself, you know, cover up, misrepresentation, more sin, more crimes. And I mean, we've really got to, in the process of covering up, in the process of restoring the situation to the right situation, not cover up. And takes integrity. I'll tell you something else, brethren and sisters, we started this out Friday night, and it comes back to haunt us yet again. The vital ingredient for leadership in the good times and in the bad times is humility. If you don't have huge swathes of humility, and I'm not talking about bunging it on, I'm talking about the genuine stuff, well, frankly, you're not going to be much of a leader. And you say, well, I don't pretend to be a leader in the ecclesia of God. I'll sit down the back row, thanks very much. I'm talking about in your families. You won't be much of a father or a husband unless you've got huge swathes of humility combined with integrity. Now, let's go to Joshua chapter 9 and let's see what's happening. Up until now, all of the nations have been fairly quiet. No one came to Jericho's aid. In Joshua chapter 8, not that we will deal with it to any great extent, but in Joshua chapter 8, when they recovered from the situation at Ai, and we saw this morning how they stoned and burnt Achan, they then went and took Ai. No one came to Ai's aid. They're all hanging back. In Joshua 9, it came to pass, verse 1, when all the kings which were on this side Jordan, in the hills, the valleys, the coasts of the great sea over against Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, underline that, we'll come back to that, the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard thereof, that they all had a meeting together and said, well, what are we going to do here? He's taken Jericho. He stumbled, but he took Ai. Who's next? Which one is he going to identify next? We got an idea. Let's not wait for him to take the initiative. Let's all have a pact together. The coalition of the willing or whatever it is. And they all banded together. Now, normally, brethren and sisters, I would suggest this would be a rare event. The record seems to be wanting to tell us of the differences and the diversities amongst the people who are banded together in this verse. On any ordinary day, forget Israel, they would be at each other's throats. You've got the ones on the coast, you've got the ones on the hills, you've got the Hivites over here, the Perizzites, and normally there might be a little bit of tension amongst them. But they put all that aside now, and it's Israel is our common enemy. Stop squabbling amongst ourselves. We've got bigger fish to fry. It's Israel. And don't let Israel pick one of us off. An attack on one is an attack upon all. We got it? Sign here. Got it? Yes, that's the way it's going to be. Well, is that the only choice they could have made? There were, I think, at least three choices that they could have made, and they chose this choice, to band together. It was a foolish choice. But anyway, there were three choices. First one is the one they make, to fight. And in chapter 10, that's exactly what they do. To fight, to take on Israel. The second choice is far simpler. They could have just got out of there. Hey, we can't stop these guys. Take the lot. We're out of here. Would have saved all their lives. No tension. Would have been a problem. You've lost all your assets, all your businesses, all your lifestyle. You've got to go and find somewhere else that's reasonably vacant. Maybe you've got to muscle your way in there as well. But if you flee, at least you don't have this juggernaut called Israel on your heels. So they could have done that. That's one option. First option, fight. Second option, flee. Third option, deceive them. Get them to believe something that's not true and trick them up in their own law. Takes a bit of cunning. And one of them said, you lot are all doomed. I'm going to go for the third option. And that was the Gibeonites. And look, let me tell you something. You might think, oh, well, the poor Gibeonites, you know, they might have been the baby group amongst the all these bands, and they probably were a little bit wary that maybe if Israel did attack them, would the others really come to their aid? Well, maybe not. I don't know how I feel about these people. And we're only a little tiny nobody group, and we'll easily get run over by Israel. That's not true. From a natural point of view, they weren't a flea-bite country at all. Have a look at chapter 10 and verse 1. Now it came to pass when Adonai, well, verse 2. All these nations feared greatly because Gibeon wasn't a pushover. Gibeon was a great city. It was one of the royal cities of the land, and it was greater than Ai, and all the men in Gibeon and allied towns were mighty. So the Gibeonites weren't coming from a position of weakness and inferiority and subordination. They were the upper echelons, mighty, powerful, but they were smart. And of the three choices, they chose deception. They were scared stiff. And so it says in chapter 9 and verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and to Ai, they did work wilily and went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles, old and rent, and bound up, and old shoes, and all that sort of stuff, and made it look as though they'd come from what they call a far country. They lived next door. Not that the Jews knew that. But they wanted to make out that they'd been travelling for a long period of time. I mean, the bread that they took with them was fresh out of the oven the day they left. And look at this horrible stuff. It's got all green stuff over it. It's
It's all dry and mouldy. I mean, why they carry dry and mouldy bread is another issue, but, you know, you can see the point. And the shoes, Julius Marlowe's, brand new, and look at them now. Wouldn't wear them on my paddock. So they obviously had thought this through to make out that they had travelled a long, long way. And they wanted to stress to Joshua, we've come from a far country. In fact, they embroider that story a bit more. Not only have we come from a far country, but in the conversation that then progresses with Joshua, not just a far country, a very far country. Long way away. Now, why is that so significant? You know, in point of fact, you know what they were doing? They were quoting back to Joshua the law of Moses. They were pretending not to, but that's exactly what they were doing. Now, look, we've got to get some background here. Go to chapter 8 and verse 28. And Joshua burnt Ai and made it a heap forever, even a desolation to this day. So he finally wins the battle against Ai. And in verse 29, and the king of Ai, he hanged on a tree until evening time. And as soon as the sun was down, Joshua commanded that they should take his carcass down from the tree and cast it at the entering of the gate of the city and raise thereon a great heap of stones that remaineth unto this day. So there was a monument outside Ai. Presumably, if you want to sort of connect the dots from previous studies we've seen, so that the children later on might say, Dad, what's that heap of stones all about? Oh, well, that was the time when we dropped the ball with Ai, but we eventually won. Okay. Now, verse 29 ends with this destruction of Ai and its king. And then we immediately jump in to verse 30. Then Joshua built an altar unto Yahweh, God of Israel, in Mount Ebal. Now, what's that all about? You've just destroyed Ai, you've tidied up that work, and then the record just makes this incidental comment about, and we built an altar at Ebal. And if you're just reading this and sort of think, oh, well, Ebal must be next door, and, you know, nice to do altars, I suppose. That's not what it's about at all. They had a burning need to get to Ebal. They wanted desperately to get to Ebal. In a sense, brethren and sisters, Jericho and Ai were just preliminaries so that they could get to Ebal. Jericho and Ai weren't the main game. It was Ebal. Why do we say that? Well, have a look at Deuteronomy chapter 27. Deuteronomy 27 and verse 2. Well, we can even begin at verse 1. Moses with the elders of Israel commanded the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I command you this day. Keep the lot of them. And it shall be, look at this, it shall be on the day when you shall pass over Jordan unto the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee, that thou shalt set thee up great stones and plaster them with plaster. So as soon as you've established yourself over the Jordan, you're to get some stones, plaster them with plaster. You're not to engrave upon them, but just plaster on the stones themselves. And verse 3, thou shalt write upon them all the words of this law when thou art passed over, that thou mayest go into the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee, a land that floweth with milk and honey, as Yahweh the God of thy fathers hath promised thee. Therefore, verse 4, it shall be, when you be gone over Jordan, we've already done that, we've gone over the Jordan, that you shall set up these stones which I command you this day in Mount Ebal. And you're going to build an altar, verse 5. Thou shalt not lift up any iron tool upon them. Build the altar. Thou shalt offer burnt offerings thereon. Offer peace offerings. Eat there. And thou shalt write upon, verse 8, upon the stones all the words of this law very plainly. Now, here's what was happening. They were going to have a Bible school at Ebal. Soon as you get over the Jordan, on the very day that you... And I'm taking this day fairly literally, verse 2. It shall be on the day when you shall pass over Jordan that you're to grab these stones. Now, Ebal's way up here. We're going to see that in a moment. You go, you make your encampment at Gilgal. On the very day that you've crossed over the Jordan, you've set yourself up at Gilgal, you're to grab these stones and you're either there or later to put plaster on them and write the entire law on these stones. Must have been a few stones. I've got a speculation. I'm not saying it's true. It's just a wild speculation that the stones may have even come out of the Jordan River themselves. Because it says on the very day that you pass over Jordan, you're to get the stones. And we've had a lot of stones come out of the Jordan. Why not these ones as well? I'm assuming that that's referring to a 24-hour day and not, you know, at the same time that you're doing, you know, that it's a technical term referring to 24-hour period. So on the very day that you cross the Jordan, you're at Gilgal, grab these stones and you're to take them to a place called Ebal. But firstly, they had to secure themselves in the land. So they go, they knock out Jericho, they eventually knock out Ai. Gibeon's just down here, as you can see on the, not the transparency, the screen. Got to turn the page over from 1952. And so they've knocked out there, and then they put everything on hold. And they're carrying these stones. Well, they've probably got them back at Gilgal. They got these stones and they put plaster on them and they're to write the law of Moses on these stones. And the whole campaign comes to a stop. The military campaign is over. No, not over, but on pause. We've got to have a Bible school. Now, they haven't exactly secured themselves in the land, but this is good enough. And there's a certain amount of faith. We've just got to have this Bible school because Deuteronomy 27 tells us we've got to have this Bible school. So let's go and have it and trust in God that we don't get armies destroy us along the way because Ebal's a fair way away. Now, this is not the scale or anything like that, but you can get a feeling for what's going on. So come over the Jordan, knock out Jericho, knock out Ai. Everything on hold, zip way up north to Ebal with these stones to build this altar and to have your Bible school for a week or whatever it was. And to rehearse the law of Moses in everybody's minds. And that's a good thing, by the way. You know, in all the sort of hubbub of any activity, whether it's ecclesial, work, family life, whatever, it's always good to take time out and just settle down to the things of God. I mean, I guess we're doing that right now. Okay? Now, whether or not they literally came there and then went straight up to Ebal or whether they just came back to Gilgal and moved up there, you know, it's irrelevant in some sense. The simple truth of the matter is they're taking time out to go to Bible school. All right? What does that mean? What does that mean for us as well? Well, it means this. Whatever takes place after Ebal, during and after Ebal, whatever takes place immediately after Ebal, Israel would have been on a spiritual high. You know, they're not wearily coming back to Gilgal. You know, and they really would like to you know, get a Bible class or two under their belt. They're on a high. They've had this wonderful time up there and they're coming back to, and their spiritual sensitivities have been enlivened. And I'll tell you, brethren and sisters, in some respects, the hardest day of the week is Monday. Straight after Bible school or memorial meeting or, you know, Sunday meetings, Sometimes the biggest challenge is Bible school because you're still is Monday because you're still back at Bible school. Your mind's spinning around, and you're not ready to be challenged by the world. You'd rather be back there in the kingdom, so to speak. And they drop the ball on Monday. Joshua dropped the ball on Monday. You and I can drop the ball on Monday, despite whatever we do across this weekend. So, they've had their Bible school at Ebal, and they come here, and they resume the campaign to destroy the land, or to take the land, and so on. And right up there at Ebal, we've got this altar, we've had burnt sacrifices, the whole thing. We've got exhortations, we've got Bible classes, we've got everything on these stones plastered, the whole law of Moses. That would have taken some time to do. All written out. Everyone would have had it rehearsed in their ears, and all the leaders and Joshua himself, listening to all that's being said here. And they would have had it very much impressed how they are to resume the campaign to take the land. Now, I want you to stay in Deuteronomy, but firstly come to Exodus chapter 34. They would have learnt this at Ebal from Exodus chapter 34. Verse 11. One of the abiding messages that they would have had from their Bible school is verse 11. Observe thou that which I command thee this day. In other words, take special note of this. Behold, I am driving out before thee the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, and the Gibeonite, who was a Hivite, and the Jebusite. Verse 12, he says it again. Be extra careful, boys. Take heed to yourself. Don't be duped into covenants with these people. Take extra precautions not to be duped. Take heed to thyself, lest thou make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land whither thou goest, lest it be for a snare in the midst of thee, but you shall destroy their altars, break their images, and cut down their groves, because we don't want any of their worship, verse 14. And verse 15, again, in case you make a covenant with these people, which I don't want you to do. And if you make a covenant with them, you'll learn all their ways, and they go whoring after their gods and do sacrifice to their gods, and you've lost everything. Be absolutely warned on this level. Now I'm labouring the point because the record's labouring the point. And they've just learnt that. It's fresh in their minds. And what was the specifics that they had to sort out? Well, let's go back to Deuteronomy, this time chapter 20. And this was all up there on the stones, all written down, all of this chapter. It's written down. Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 10. When thou comest near to a city to fight against it, then proclaim peace unto it. What city? It shall be, if it make thee an answer of peace and open unto thee, then it shall be that all the people that is found therein shall be servants to thee, and they shall serve thee. But which cities? Well, verse 15 tells us, thus shalt thou do to all the cities which are very far off from thee, which are not the cities of the Canaanites. You know, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, not those ones. These are ones that are beyond, very far away. Let's just put it up on the... There are two destinies. The second destiny is found in verse 16. But of the cities of these people, the Canaanites, which Yahweh thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breathes. Thou shalt utterly destroy them. No covenants, no agreements, no deals, no trading, no barter, nothing. Verse 17, you shall utterly destroy everything that breathes. And if you're not quite sure whom I'm referring to, says God, I'll spell it out. There they are, the Hittites, the Amorites, and so on, at the end of verse 17. And these are the ones on the screen. There are two groups of people with two destinies. Here's the Canaanites with all these tribes and stuff. And the Gibeonites were part of this. They were Hivites. Of those, that's it. No correspondence will be entered into. You just get rid of the lot. We might squirm about that and, you know, genocide and all that sort of stuff, but that's the way God wants it. Because he doesn't want the pollution, the moral pollution of this group to infect Israel. Now, that's not a bad point in a way. You know, if your arm offends you, sometimes the best thing to do is just chop the thing off. If your eye offends you, pluck it out. You know, be a bit brutal at times. And if your television's taking up too much time in your home, get rid of it. Okay, two destinies. This is the first one. Wipe them out totally. Then there are those outside of this grouping from a very far country. It's okay to come up to these people and offer them terms of peace. If they're going to be belligerent, you wipe them out. But if they are going to be fairly conducive to peaceful intentions that you're bringing with them, you are to make them subordinate to you as, you know, servants. So you spare them if there are peaceful intentions that they're showing. Well, there they are. There's the Gibeonites. Way down there. There's Ai, there's Jericho. Obviously, I'm just splattering it across there. Look, I don't think, brethren and sisters, that that's terribly hard at all. I mean, you know, that's not rocket science. You've got Exodus 34 pounding it into your ears. You've got Deuteronomy 20 spelling it out in specific terms in this inner core here. Get rid of them. Nothing that... You don't let survive anything that breathes. Now, what could be clearer than that? And then you've got a process for dealing with these out there. Now, the Gibeonites seem to be borrowing from Deuteronomy 20. What's going on here? How did that happen? Well, let's just go back a bit. There they are, up at Ebal. Ai is gone and Gibeon and all these other countries, they're all massing together and working out how they're going to sort this thing out. They've got time to work it out because these guys are off pausing everything up at Ebal. And then they go back to Gilgal. And I reckon this is what happened. All of these groupings of nations, including Gibeon, would have sort of said, what's going on? Out with the binocular. What are they doing now? Who are they going to pick on next? Which of our cities? Well, they're not doing anything at all. They're actually having a bit of a holiday. Holiday? Don't believe that. No, I think they're just going up to Ebal and just having a Bible school. Oh, come on. No, that's exactly what they're doing. So what are they doing up there? Is there some strange sort of druidic thing that they're doing? No, they're just, you know, they've got altars and they're talking about the law of Moses. In fact, they're writing it out on rocks. Really? Yeah. Well, what does it say on the rocks? Well, let's go and have a look. So here's Israel. They go back to Gilgal. And they're all, and the ambassador, what's on the rocks? Look at the rocks, and there they go. And they say, look, it's all written in Hebrew. Got a Hebrew dictionary out, you know, Hebrew Hivite dictionary. What's that word there? That's us. Oh, cut it out. Boris, you never done. It is us. They're talking about us. What are they saying? We're dead. Oh, no, that's no good. And all these people saying, all the more reasons to steel yourselves, boys. Steel yourselves. You know? Close up, we're all going to fight together. Fight against one is a fight against all. You got that? Yeah, we got that. The Gibeonites said, uh-uh. They didn't say that to their mates. What else does it say there on the rocks? Well, let me just go. There's something about these other guys who are very far countries, you know, a long way away. What does it say about them? Well, they can be dealt with fairly benevolently. Oh, how does that work? Well, if we're prepared to have peaceful intentions with them and we're prepared to be their servants, they'll sign a covenant with us. Oh, really? Very good. Interesting. So they race back to Gibeon. They have a powwow with all the leaders and they say, quick, get your mouldy old bread and your battered up Julius Marlowe's and let's go off to Gilgal and talk to them. So away they go. And here's the conversation back in Joshua chapter 9. They did work wilily, verse 4, and went and made as if they had been ambassadors and took old sacks upon their asses and wine bottles and so on and so on. Old shoes, verse 5, and all the bread was mouldy at the end of verse 5. And they went right up to Joshua and their ambassadors. No weapons in their hands. No weapons. Ambassadors are men of peace. And they say in verse 6, they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, we be come from a far country, now therefore make a league with us. Sign here. I've written it all out. All you've got to do is put your John Henry on the bottom. Huh? Where are you from? That's what he says. And the men of Israel said to the Hivites, not that they knew that they were Hivites, the men of Israel said to the Hivites, well, look, it could be that you really aren't from a far country. It could be that you dwell next door. And we can't make a league with you if that's the case. Exodus 34, Deuteronomy 20, they got that part right. And they said to Joshua, we are thy servants. We've come from a far country, you know the thing, far country. We're your servants. And Joshua said, well, just hold on a tick, boys. Who exactly are you? I mean, you said you're from a far country. Which direction? Where are you from? Who's your mum and dad? And from whence come ye? And they didn't answer the question. Not really. Look at verse 9. They said to him, we're from a very far country, thy servants are come, because the name of Yahweh thy God, for we have heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt. They didn't answer the questions of verse 8. They just reiterated what they'd said earlier. Or they embroidered it a bit. They're no longer a far country, it's now a very far country, even further out in the paddock. And Joshua could have said, yeah, I hear all that. But look, what's your ethnic grouping? Now come on, get a bit more specific here. Who exactly are you? But you know, when you've got ambassadors and they've got all the props, and when they start telling you how great you are, we're your servants and we've come for, because of a religious motive, because of the name of Yahweh thy God, and then they say, we've heard the fame of him and all that he did in Egypt. In Egypt? Come on, that's ancient history. That's a long time ago. Well, they're not going to talk about AI, are they? It's the last thing you mention. Oh, how on earth did you know about that? If mobile phone network's not working at the moment, how did you know that? Oh, they planned it pretty well. And all verse 10, look at this, all that he did to the kings of the Amorites that were beyond Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, which was at Ashtaroth. Again, almost ancient history. Wherefore our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, take victuals with you for the journey, go to meet them and say unto them, we are your servants, now sign here. And you know what the mistake Joshua made? A simple mistake. We make it all the time. He didn't go to God in prayer. Had he gone to through Eleazar the priest with the Urim and the Thummim and worked out that this was just a big story, it would have been a different result. He didn't say, okay, boys, look, can you just allow me to be excused for about half an hour? I've got some other business to attend to. Just go over there. The sisters will make you a nice cup of tea. There's some pavlova that's left over from the meeting this morning. Just help yourself. I just got something else that I want to go and do. And he'd go and see Eleazar the priest. And say, look, they're saying this, but I just don't know. Can you give me an answer from God? And the answer would have been, hey, you're being conned. Thank you very much. We'll go back. He didn't consult God then, and he didn't consult God even later when he had an opportunity. And the record later specifically mentions that. And you know, on other occasions, I mean, David, we won't go anywhere, we haven't got time, but David would consistently ask God at each turn in a battle, do I go up and fight them? Yes, go up and fight them. And he'd make a partial victory. Do I then go up again? No, don't go up again. Oh, okay, so I'm not to go. And David would continually defer to his heavenly father. After all, God was the commander in chief. What do I do now? Do you want me to do this? Do you want me to do that? No, no, do this, do that. Go around the mulberry bush, whatever. Not Joshua. Why? Why do you think? Is this Joshua just a failing of his character? Well, it is, I guess, in one sense. But when you're being flattered, you're vulnerable to believe anything. And here's these people with a vast religious conviction, or apparently so, flattering Israel. Here's a nation that's come from afar just to see them, appealing to Israel's history and telling them how wonderful Israel's history was. Careful not to tell of any recent victories so that, well, I think what would have happened then is that all the elders within Israel would have said, oh, you've heard about Egypt, obviously, and these other victories. So you don't know anything about Jericho or Ai? No, what happened there? Oh, well, you should pack of cards, boom, and the whole bit, and we dropped the ball a little bit with Ai, but look, we picked it up. Really? Isn't that the most amazing thing? Didn't know anything about that? Fantastic. Well, look, we'd love to be your servants. And so they bung on this story about bread in verse 12 and bottles of wine filled new on day one in verse 13, and they're all old and battered, shoes needing repaired, very long journey. And the elders within Israel, verse 14, took of their food and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. A half an hour of a pause was all that was needed, and they got duped. And Ebal and the warnings of Ebal were ringing in their ears. But flattery and circumstances and good acting blanked it all out. And so in verse 15, it looks as though they had it under his nose all this time. Joshua made peace with them. They had this letter. It had all been nicely presented by them. All he had to do was sign on the bottom line. He didn't have to do anything else. Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them to let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear to them. Look, brethren and sisters, and I don't mind that this is the last of our studies that we make this point. And I can only speak for myself. I don't know your lives particularly. But I just wonder whether we don't pray enough. I I mean, real prayer, not at the mealtime. Look, well, you do pray at the mealtime, but you know what I mean. Real honest-to-goodness prayer. Time-out prayer. You might think that where I live, we wouldn't lead a busy life. You know, it's a little bit less cluttered and less hurly-burly than in the cities. Well, if it is, then I'm glad I don't live here because I'd be even worse. There are days, and I say this to my shame, and I've now got it on record, that I don't think I really pray at all. Oh, yeah, some form of words at meal times and words at the end of the day before I drop to the pillow and forget everything. I'm talking about real prayer. Maybe we don't pray enough, brethren and sisters. Maybe we don't at lunchtime go out to the car park and get into the car and just sit there and pray to God. And at home, after we put the children in bed, spend time with yourself, perhaps with your wife, and just pray to God a special prayer. Is it because we don't see the relevance of it? Is it because we somehow think that, well, we're in the ecclesia and we're busy with the things of God that, you know, maybe it's something that we don't have to pay too much attention to? I don't know what the ruse is in my mind. Maybe I'm just too busy and I get conned and flattered and taken in by all of the things of the world and then 10 o'clock comes around and I haven't prayed properly to my Heavenly Father all day. Well, that was the mistake they made. And boy, was it a mistake. Look at this. Verse 17, the children of Israel journeyed and came to their cities on the third day. Their cities were Gibeon and Sapphira and Beeroth and Kirjath-Jearim. And the children of Israel got a bit upset by this. The children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn to them by Yahweh, God of Israel. So here we are, after this league's been taken, we've got our path through here sorted out, and we're just about to move south and to take them. Oh, it's you lot. Hey, hold on, you said you were from a far country. What's going on here? And the arranging brethren have made a decision to protect you. Oh, those arranging brethren, I always did have my doubts when it was election time. Always did have a few misgivings about that election, you know. They murmured. And, you know, look, let's call it what it is. It's faithless. This is the first time, by the way, that you hear murmuring as they conquered Canaan. First time. God hates murmuring. God equates murmuring with rebellion. Now, it's not... Don't think that I'm saying to you that you can't ever complain about something in a constructive way. We're not talking about that. We're talking about white-anting people and talking behind backs and scheming and grumping all the time about decisions that are made within the ecclesia of God. And maybe there are bad decisions, brethren and sisters. Maybe you should have put the gospel extension work over in this suburb and not in that suburb. Maybe you should have. And maybe somebody didn't listen to you when you suggested it, and they spent $20,000 with a leaflet distribution, and they got very little response, and had they, you know, all that sort of stuff. Maybe all that's right. And you're grumping and carrying on, oh, they don't listen to me, and, you know, if only they'd listen to me, would have saved us, and all that sort of stuff. That's murmuring. And God equates that with rebellion, and he equates that with faithlessness. Now, we haven't got time to turn to it, but you know, God is angry when we murmur. And the children of Israel, when they started 40 years earlier, murmuring in the wilderness, God says, I hate this. What? Can't they have any faith in me at all? They're always grumping. Oh, there's no water. Do you think I'm going to let them die? Of course I'm going to send them water. They can't last for a day without their flex time and all the other. They're always looking at number one. They're never, ever thinking in a spiritual sense. And they grump and they grump. And they grump against Moses. He was God's representative. So they're really grumping against me. Don't they trust me at all? And all I get from it, not prayer, not thanksgiving, not glory from their lips, all they tell me is how bad I'm doing a job for them. Well, that's it, says God. Let their carcasses drop in the wilderness. That's what God said. I didn't make that up. Let their carcasses drop in the wilderness. You ever said that at a funeral? That's what God thought of them. They're just like sheep and cattle that drop dead in the paddock, and let it be that way. That's what I think of them, says God. And you've got a reoccurrence of this in verse 18. All the congregation murmured against the arranging brethren. Who knows what could have happened? Split in the ecclesia. Oh, we're going our way. We got our little grouping, and you can do. We got no trust in you anymore. No, we're out of here. We'll set up our own ecclesia on the other side of the suburb. You know, all that sort of stuff. What are they going to do? You've got a major crisis of leadership in the ecclesia now. Everything's falling to bits now, potentially. What are you going to do? Deals under the table? Appease their wrath? Good luck. You're only as good as the next turn of events, and then you've got to do it again. What are you going to do? What do leaders do? I think they did the most beautiful thing that a leader could do when he's dropped the ball. They made a mistake. They fessed up. They were humble about it. They've got integrity. And they said, okay, look, we can't go back on this word. We've signed on the dotted line. Look at verse 19. All the princes said to the congregation, we've sworn unto them by Yahweh, God of Israel. Look, that's just the way it is. We can't touch them. We're not going to break another commandment to try and fix the mess that we've just created. Not like David with Bathsheba, where he just compounded sin upon sin upon sin and it just all got out of hand. I'm not trying to bag out David. He's a wonderful person. But on that occasion, things went wrong. Let's just be open and upfront and be honest with everybody and say, okay, we've made this decision. It was a silly decision. We've signed it. We've sworn to Yahweh regarding these people. We cannot now retract that. If you don't like me, I'm prepared to put in my resignation as an arranging brother, but that's just the way it is, and I'm prepared to follow through with this. What we will do, however, this we will do, verse 20, we will let them live, lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swear unto them. And in verse 23, now therefore ye are cursed, they say to the Gibeonites, and there shall none of you be freed from being bondmen and hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God. And verse 24, relieved by all of these events, because it could have gone awfully awry for them, they answered Joshua and said, look, we had spies out there reading the rocks. Because it was certainly told thy servants how that Yahweh thy God commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy that inner core of people, the red part on our screen. Therefore, we were sore afraid of our lives because of you and have done this thing. And then they say, look, we'll take any job. We'll clean toilets. We'll mow the lawn, the ecclesial lawn. Every week, we'll do whatever you like to spare our lives. Behold, we are in thine hand, verse 25, as it seemeth good and right to thee to do unto us, do. And so did he unto them and delivered them out of the hand of the children of Israel that they slew them not. I think that's a wonderful piece of turning a negative into a positive. I think they showed wonderful leadership The Gibeonites became servants within Israel. In fact, in many respects, they were good servants, as we know from later in history. They acknowledged their heavenly Father, and like Rahab and others, they grafted themselves not into the hope of Israel, but into Israel itself. Well, brothers and sisters, that brings us to the conclusion of our short study around Joshua this weekend. And we've traversed a lot of areas here. It's been lessons in character, I'm sure. I'm sure you've felt that it's been very close to the bone, very personal on occasions, very uncomfortable. I'll go so far as to say, brothers and sisters, if it hasn't been uncomfortable for you, as it has been equally uncomfortable for me, as I said on our first night, I haven't done my job. We need to be lifted out of our comfort zone so that we can change our worldview and our thinking and be challenged. So I want to finish our small study of Joshua where we started. I'd like you to turn to Joshua chapter 24. Before we read from that chapter, I want to read from you Proverbs chapter 3. It says, "Trust in Yahweh with all thine heart. Don't lean unto thine own understanding in every aspect of your life, in everything that you do, in all thy ways, big and small, whatever decisions that you're having to make in your families, in your ecclesias, in your personal life." And we spoke a bit about that last night with the young people. "In everything that we do, acknowledge God, and he shall direct your paths in ways that you probably will never properly understand." His ways are inscrutable on many occasions. But let's then make it into an imperative. Right now, an imperative as we leave this place. Verse 14, the end of Joshua's life. The parting message that Joshua has given us as we part this place. Verse 14, "Now therefore fear Yahweh and be a servant to our Heavenly Father in sincerity and in truth." And if your life is cluttered with idolatry and covetousness, because they're the same thing, well, get rid of it. Unclutter your life of idolatry and covetous. Put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the flood and in Egypt, and then you'll be able to serve Yahweh so much the better when you simplify your life and get rid of all the distractions. And if it seems evil to you to serve Yahweh, well, look, don't sit on the fence. Don't try and have a foot in both camps. Don't try and juggle this sort of weird, I'm in the world and I'm in the ecclesia and I somehow want to have both worlds. You'll get neither world. If it seems evil to you to serve Yahweh, well, make a decision now. Choose you this day whom you will serve. You may not have tomorrow. And Joshua didn't, literally. He was about to die. Choose you today, now, this day, whom you're going to serve, whether the gods which your father served that were on the other side of the flood, or the gods of those Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as far as I'm concerned, I may not be able to change you, says Joshua. I've tried hard all my life in the leadership that God gave me. Maybe I failed a bit, he says. Maybe the only lasting vestige of influence that I've really got, when it's all said and done, is my own family, will choose you this day, him yourself, as far as I'm concerned, and my house, he says, as for me and my house, it's Yahweh. Let us be going, and let us do the same.